Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Dan and Benny in the Ring, a special edition as a huge moment, great stuff to talk about. Benny, I know this is an anniversary show in sorts for us. It's the start of our second season. It's also a tribute to who is a man who is easily the greatest of all time. I'm Dan Spasciano, joined as always by the BS Express himself, Benny Scala. Benny, how you doing?
I'm here talking about my hero with two great guys who were friends of Bruno. So life doesn't get any better than it does right now.
Well, you mentioned two guys. Why don't you introduce the guests we have on the show today?
All right. And it's my pleasure. The first one is, and they can't see it because they're on the phone, but I'm holding up the book, Bruno Sammartino, The Autobiography of Wrestling's Living Legend. That was compiled by Sal Corrente, who's a friend of mine. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Sal when he was traveling in my neighborhood. He had a hot dog at the Lucky Dill restaurant that was so big that Babe Ruth could have had batting practice with it. And I'm going to get to the book in a second, but I wanted to introduce Sal, and then I wanted to introduce Davey. And Davey O'Hannon occupied so many Saturday mornings in my lifetime as a kid. The minute that Joe McHugh said, "From Kansas City, Missouri," all was right in the world. I mean, there could have been a loud boom outside, and I could have looked out my window, and I've said this before, there could have been a mushroom cloud outside. I would have waited till a commercial before I looked to see what was going on, because that's how invested I was in All-Star Championship Wrestling on Saturday morning. So it is, like, I mean, beyond a pleasure and a privilege to have these two gentlemen to talk about my hero, Bruno Sammartino. And I guess before we get into any of the questions, I did want to, you know, one of the fans on the podcast page, I believe, asked Sal about the book. Actually, a couple of people asked Sal about the book. And Sal said something about going on Amazon and reading the reviews. And I actually wrote one of those reviews, but I want to give a quick, you know, Reader's Digest 30, maybe a little bit more than that, 30-second review of this amazing book. You know, I was going to say that if you're a fan of Bruno's, you have to have this book. And then I thought to myself, you know what? If you're a fan of wrestling, you have to have this book. And then I thought, you know what? If you're a fan of life, you have to have this book, because this is really one of the most amazing stories in the history of mankind, because this is a man who grew up in poverty in Italy. And either one of you two gentlemen can correct me if I make any mistakes here, but grew up in Italy, you know, when he was, I believe, about maybe 10 years old, the Nazis invaded his hometown of Pizzaferrato, Italy, and he had to live up in a mountain for about a year and a half with his brother and sister and his mother. And literally, for some, you know, at times, they had to live on dandelions and snow just to, you know, to not starve to death. And every once in a while, his, you know, his mother, who was, he said, was the most courageous person he ever met in his life, had to literally, it was about a day or a day and a half trip going back down the mountain, back to their house, sneaking into the basement and getting some corn or wheat or flour, just so they would have food. And I believe one time she actually got shot by the Nazis when she was, you know, when she was leaving the house. Bruno had rheumatic fever when he was a child that his mother actually tried to treat with leeches. And I believe he lost at least a couple of his siblings due to illness. And his mother swore that she wouldn't lose any others. And Bruno couldn't even come to America until he was 14 because he could not pass the physical to come into this country. And when he got here, I believe he was 14, a little bit over 14 years old, weighed 83 pounds, got beat up at school because he couldn't speak the English language, and from turned all that into being the very greatest at what he did ever. Just, I mean, to me, that besides, you know, being a wrestling fan, if he would have been anything, even a car salesman, it's just a phenomenal story. So I would recommend anybody who's listening to go buy this book. It's just I mean, I can't even think of the adjectives to describe it. Wonderful, phenomenal. I'll read it. I've read it from cover to cover 2 to 3 times. And every once in a while, it's one of these books that you can read one of the chapters. Like I read both Davey and Sal's chapters before the podcast, and I probably read them like 5 or 6 times each. So I just can't say enough about this book. It's this isn't a Mick Foley cheap pop. This is from the heart that I absolutely love this book. So that's all I got to say about that, as far as Gump would say.
Well, you know what? You hit it right on the head, because we're not dealing with just a wrestler here. You know, this when you say the living legend or everyone's idol, you know, Bruno was, and like you said, tough to find adjectives to describe him. He was such a good person that persevered through against incredible odds. And his mom was the strongest lady that you could ever hope to meet. And I don't mean physical strength, which she did have. She was so determined. And you're right. I mean, I heard the stories of crawling up the mountain right from Bruno, right in the front seat of a car. We talked about it a lot of times. And it was just incredible what he went through to achieve what he achieved. You know, that just goes to show you anybody can achieve in America what you want to achieve if you persevere. And you're right. Listen, he did it all. He did it all. And he did it all before the wrestling business. The icing on the cake was the wrestling business. And the wrestling business was better for years and years because Bruno was there.
Oh, absolutely. It's remarkable to think, if I may, like, for example, it came up on the show last year. There was an article, Mr. Hannon, there was an article referencing you joining the board for the International Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Uh-huh.
And that was approximately, I don't know, what was that? At least more than 30 years since your last match at Madison Square Garden.
And maybe, yeah.
There was still a huge reaction because of what you guys and that crop and that genre that Bruno championed and led meant to the business. I mean, we talk about it all the time, and Benny's, it's come up on the show before. You have fans in their 20s and teenagers that are huge fans of wrestling back then, because they can still pull up the tapes and they still watch the moments, and they hear, you know, people our age and people your age, older, the older generations talk about how great things were. I don't see that. I don't see 20, 30 years from now fans watching tapes of shows filmed today and falling in love with wrestling in the same way. And I'm wondering, what is it about that style, specifically Bruno's, his appearances in ring, the way, just the way he carried himself, that's so generational, that just anybody who watches it for the first time just falls in love with wrestling?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's a personal connection that you get watching Bruno or watching a lot of the guys that worked during those days, and that's what the book covers. Unlike a lot of wrestling books that are done, this is. A history book as well as a Bruno Sammartino book, and it shows the history of one man, but it speaks to what used to be. Bruno, and a lot of us hope we could live up to it, but Bruno's the guy. He lent such legitimacy to our business, and you know, we all had a little saying that the fans believed because we believed. We never insulted the fans. You know, we didn't say the word storyline. You know, we were insulted if somebody said script, if they said the F word. You know, we had a lot of different answers for that. You know, I don't know what you're watching on television right now, but I can prove to you that I'm not fake. You know, we could do that. But Bruno right. didn't even have to do that. Just by his presence, his demeanor, and the respect that he commanded, you know, people had no doubts about Bruno, whether you were a fan or not. So he gave legitimacy to the business. And you know, that's just one of his legacies.
I mean, you can't argue with that. Benny, you've got two legends themselves talking about your true hero. Go for it.
I have a question for Sal, because Sal said something in the book that I actually heard something similar on a podcast. And Sal mentioned that, you know, Bruno's the only wrestler that he gave up the title. The promoter didn't come to him and say, Bruno, it's time for you to drop the belt. Bruno went to the Vince McMahon and said, you know what? I'm tired. You know, I'm hurt. I want to spend time with my family. So my question for Sal is, you know, if Bruno, and this is kind of a, it's a totally hypothetical question, but if Bruno wasn't Bruno, say Bruno actually had an ego, which he didn't have, but say Bruno decided that, you know, his family didn't mean as much to Bruno as it did. But what if Bruno decided that he wanted to keep going and keep wrestling? How long could he have held the title?
Well, this is what I'll tell you, that when Bruno made a forced comeback and he got in the ring and it went from boxing rings to what Bruno called the trampoline, you know, he told the guys in the back, because he had no idea what it was going to, you know, what it was going to be. Well, but when he got back there, he said, guys, if I had rings like this when I was working, he said, I would have been here 15 years. So, you know, I would assume that there wouldn't have been much change if the physical pain didn't get to him. You know, there might have been a schedule change in, you know, part of the problem is, and I don't think this made a lot of sense in the long run. In the short run, it probably seemed brilliant. But having Bruno work all these secondary clubs just didn't make any sense when, you know, guys like Strongbow and, you know, some of the other DiNucci, these guys working with people like Fuji and Tanaka and stuff. These guys could have sold these places out. They didn't need Bruno in these secondary clubs. So if they would have been able to protect him and give him a little time with his family, a little time to heal, instead of just constantly taking a beating, I think that, of course, that also would have extended him greatly, because when they came and asked him to come back, it was, hey, you won't have to work the small clubs anymore. You know, and you'll be just 3 or 4 days a week. So ultimately, when they came to him and they said, or he went to them and said, okay, the year's up, and, you know, find somebody to take this belt. And they said, well, what's the problem? So we kept our word. You're only working 3 or 4 days a week. You're being paid well. And he told me, he said, look, I thought about it. It was true. He said they were paying me well, and they did keep their word. So I figured I'd hang around for another length of time. But eventually enough was enough, and he put his foot down, and that's when they went to Billy Graham.
But you know what? Keep in mind that if Bruno wanted to stay, business-wise, he could have stayed, because it would have been silly to say no to him. But you also have to understand, in his prime, there was nobody, emphasis on nobody, that could have taken that belt away from him. You got to understand that. He was an absolute machine. A machine. There was nobody that was conditioned like him. There was certainly nobody that was as strong as him. Was he a great technical wrestler? Nah, he wasn't a great technician. He knew how to wrestle. But if Bruno felt like staying, and if he had a different personality, he could have said, you know what? I'm not going anywhere. Why don't you get somebody to take this belt from me? Yeah, okay. And let me tell you something. There wouldn't have been too big a line for that offer.
Oh my God! Davey, from your perspective, why don't you talk a little bit about His, the one reason I think that, and Bruno mentioned this many, many times, and I have to agree with him, he was not repetitive. He made sure the fans were not seeing the same thing month in and month out. He would change things around so people could get used to the same stuff. And I think to have that kind of longevity, you can't be repetitive unless you're getting a lot of help, a lot of help underneath, which Bruno was not getting a lot of help underneath.
Well, if you remember back when a lot of us were fans, every couple of months there was another heel would come in to work with Bruno. And if you were a dyed-in-the-wool fan, you watched and you said to yourself, this could be the one. This could be the one. And like you said, there wasn't repetition. They didn't all look alike, all right? Might have been Oscar Verdoux and then Fred Blassie. Or it might have been Waldo Von Erich, Mike Cicluna. There were guys that came in that really had the fans saying to themselves, "Oh boy, this is really going to be tough. Boy, I hope it's okay." And they'd see a different program every month, sometimes a couple of months, but it was different all the time. It was different all the time. It wasn't that cookie cutter, same old stuff. It wasn't, let's hop up on the top. I don't think I ever saw Bruno climb up on a second or third rope and talk and talk to the fans. He was humble. He was the champ. I mean, it was incredible how he carried himself. We were sitting in a dressing room in Philadelphia one night, and, a lot of the guys played cards. I was sitting off to the side talking to whoever. And a guy named Gino Hernandez came in. He was about to do a really short stay in New York for a number of reasons. It was short. But he came in, and he was wearing his whatever belt it was that he was carrying around with him in the dressing room. Okay, well, listen, you're with the boys now. You don't have to convince us anything. We're just waiting to do our job here. And he walked over to where Bruno was sitting, and Mike was there, and Dominic, and whoever else was sitting around. And he says, I'm Gino Hernandez. I got the belt in Detroit there. And so Bruno looked up and went, "Oh, hi. Yeah, my name's Sam Martino. They said I got some belt here or something like that. I got the belt here." "Oh," he says, "yeah, nice to meet you." "What?" "Wait a minute. When I first came into New York, I was sitting in a dressing room, and Bruno walked over. And, protocol used to be in the business. If you didn't know somebody or you knew in a territory, you'd go into the dressing room, and you would walk around and introduce yourself. Stick your hand out. Shake hands, tell him your name." And I'm sitting on a bench, and I see him walk in, and I went to myself, "Holy crap, this is Bruno Sammartino in the same room with me. Wait a minute, what's going on here?" And he walked over, and he went, "Hey, how you doing, kid?" He said, "Sammartino." And I looked up and said, "Oh, yeah, I know." He said, "Your name is I know?" I said, "Oh, no, my name's Davey." I said, "Sorry." He had no ego. He had no ego. Boy, if anybody could have had an ego, he sure could have. Because he had, like they say in baseball, what is it, five tools? Bruno had them all.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Bruno had them all. And to, just to go back for a second, when you talk about the book, well, you'll get that from the book, but you'll also get, you'll get such intimate detail on his life. It's just, I've read it a couple of times too. I mean, I'm still in shock that I was even asked to have a picture of me in that book. After I spoke to Sal and I said, "Did you talk to Bruno about this?" He said, yeah, everything's okay. I hung up with Sal. I went to my wife. I said, "You're not even going to believe this." She said, "What?" I said, they asked if they could use a picture of me in the book." She said, "What book?" I said, "Bruno's book." I think she said, "Well, okay, you could die tomorrow now and you'll be happy." that's it for you. You know, he could have been there forever if he wanted to. He could have been there forever.
You talked about
numbers don't lie. Right?
That's right.
The money was there. And this is what, you know, I struggle sometimes to say things that I don't necessarily want to say. But the bottom line is nobody would ever lose a title if the money was still there. They don't make changes and go out and find new talent because money is still coming in the way it should.
Right.
Right. I mean, those are just facts. This is all driven by revenue. And that's
business,
where you're making the changes. And you know, there were times guys came into the territory to Vince McMahon had to do a favor for them. And Bruno didn't really feel that some of these guys were qualified to headline Madison Square Garden.
No doubt about it.
Look, this is the way it is. He said, you can't program. He said, I was the champion. Sometimes they just needed to see me beat somebody right in the middle. So
that's
I could
exactly
use these guys
right.
That were big, you know, big size guys. They at least kind of looked the part. And that would be that. So
yep.
All of that went into it. This, you know, look, some territories were weekly. Of course, they were only going to the Garden and these big clubs monthly. But how long does it take a fan to figure out, hey, we know what we're going to see here. There's going to be a double count out. There's going to be a DQ. They're going to have a blow-off match. Or if they go to the cage, then Bruno's – you know what I mean? So
yep.
Sometimes there were tag matches that took place, whether or not – you know, and look, I think the old man knew that there were times Bruno was helping people out. Like somebody would say, hey, could you get me a main event in the Garden? So, of course, they could tag with Bruno, and then they'd get a main event where they would never got a main event otherwise. So there were a lot of things that he did, but it was always keeping within the business and trying to do the best business he could for the company.
Yeah, and Bruno, on that same note, Bruno took really good care of the other wrestlers. I know he approached Vince Sr. once. There was a guy working in the territory, Journeyman, who was a really solid worker. And Bruno went to Vince Sr. and said, hey, this guy has been working in this business forever, and he never refuses anything that you ask him to do. He gives you a good product. He doesn't embarrass anybody or himself. And he's never made $1,000 in a week. What are you doing here? And Bruno fixed it. J.J. Dillon, Jim Morrison, was a referee. J.J., when he was refereeing, refereed Bruno and Killer Kowalski in the Boston Gardens. And then I think they did a return in Fenway Park. But anyway, they did some kind of angle, and one of them swung a chair and clocked J.J. in the head, got a lot of color in the ring. And J.J., you know, that was that. That was part of the angle that night. And he got his payoff, and he just happened to be casually talking to Bruno. And he said, geez, I thought it would be better than this because of the house and all the stuff that was going on. Bruno said, what do you mean? What did you get? And he told him how much he got paid. And Bruno said to J.J., don't bring it up again. Don't open your mouth. That's that. Now, we knew what that meant. We knew that Bruno was going to take care of that. And sure enough, a week later, in whatever town they were in, Phil Zacco walked up to J.J., and counted out another $500. You know, we're talking back in the 60s.
It's a lot of money.
We're talking back in the 60s.
Yeah, it was a lot of money.
Counted off and said, here, this is yours, kid. And,
you know, the key to that story isn't how much extra he got paid. It's the idea that a guy of Bruno's stature took time to worry about a referee who went out there,
absolutely,
worked hard. He had to get color that night, the whole thing, and all he got was his normal pay, which I think, if I remember correctly, was about $100.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But
yeah.
Where, in what territory do you find people going out of their way and going to the promoters and saying, hey, you know, this is not right? And,
Forget it.
You know, that's a whole other thing.
Forget it. I was in a lot of territories, man. I worked in plenty of territories. New York was unique, and it was unique because of Bruno. Bruno commanded respect, but he also commanded respect for the other wrestlers. And he would never tolerate somebody making a joke of the business or demeaning the business. I mean, he was like a babysitter for a lot of us. He took care of a lot of guys. And he made sure that wrestling was wrestling. You know, that's what it was all about.
And on the same note, because everything Davey said is 100% true, if you look back at a lot of the early cards, they were pretty weak cards. You would find Bruno was in the main event, and everything underneath was not really strong.
That's right.
It was, like I said earlier, no real support. Well, they would have guys, you know, like the Kangaroos and stuff, and these guys would be in secondary clubs and loading those things up. So the office was making money twice, which is totally fine. But Bruno said, look, this has got to stop. The fans are being cheated. They said, but they still buy the tickets. They want to see you. They're getting you. And he said, no, it doesn't work that way.
That's right.
You've got to put better cards in these big clubs. But this is a good effect for any business, you know. And that's the key, is keeping people happy. I mean, Bruno could have sat around just worried about himself, but he didn't. And ultimately, that's what made the company a stronger company. And let's face it, as strong as the company is today, you know, Bruno's had to save the company a couple of times. You had this whole Stan Hansen thing in Shea Stadium. I mean, that turned into a fiasco with Ali and Inoki. That certainly was going to be a complete disaster.
It sure was.
What else can you say? He did his thing, and he achieved the level of greatness that he achieved, and he fought the battles. I mean, that's what you have to say, because he could have easily been out of the business if it wasn't for Jay York, getting him the spot up there in Toronto, which he could have lost if business had been strong in Toronto. There would have been a big problem. Because they might not have given Bruno a chance when that phone call was made.
Yep. And let me tell you, you go to a different territory, like I did, and the first thing after you get comfy there, somebody would say to you, oh, did you ever get to work in the garden? Yep. You know, after a while, that's just another arena for you in the territory. But the other question they always asked, do you know Bruno? You know, what kind of guy is he? You know, I heard he's an okay guy. I heard he sticks up for the boys. Yeah, sure does. Unreal. And you know, he scolded me a few times. He kind of babysat me, a couple of times. Come with me for a second. Say, here we go. You know, he'd walk into the shower or somewhere alone. He never embarrassed anybody. He never did it in front of people. But he was such a presence. He was such a presence in the business. To get to be around him a lot was just surreal. It really was.
I have a question, if I could. Well, first I have a comment, because as a fan, I became a fan in 1968. My very first show was on April 26th, 1968, at the Island Garden. And it was Bruno versus Toru Tanaka in the main event. And the two of them went off, you know, they collided in the middle of the ring. And I swear it sounded like an earthquake. And Bruno got up
with
a count of 10. Bruno was the winner. I was hooked. I mean, here I am, almost 53 years to the day after that. And the man is still my hero. But, going back to what you guys said, it was such a great formula. They bring in this heel. Like, I remember the first one was Virgil Butcher. I think his real name was John Quinn.
Yeah, John Quinn.
And he went through everybody. I remember that Ray Morgan made a comment that the Kentucky Butcher beat Edouard Carpentier in the Garden, which, like, that was unheard of. Nobody beat Carpentier in the Garden. And that led to the big match between Bruno and Butcher. And I guess Butcher on TV, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, Butcher faced Arnold Skolin on Capitol Wrestling. Butcher pile drove Arnold, you know, so, and then at the time, all of Butcher's opponents were getting carried out on a stretcher.
Yeah.
So, you know, Arnie's getting carried out on a stretcher, and Butcher and Bobby Davis, both at the same time, lift the stretcher up. Arnie flies out of the ring and supposedly lands on his neck.
Yep.
And then the next week, Ray Morgan is telling people to send cards and letters to White Plains Hospital to, you know, to, you know, for Arnie. And of course that, you know, that built up a lot of heat for the Garden. But, you know, then after that, after it was Butcher, then it was Rocky Fitzpatrick, which is Bob Orton Sr.
Yep.
And every time this happened, I thought, oh crap, this is going to be, cause I'm a 13-year-old kid. I'm thinking, this is the guy that's going to beat my hero. And then after that, it was George Steele. And I really, I mean, George Steele scared the crap out of me. But it worked for years and years and years. And then, like, fast forward to 1980, and Bruno's wrestling Larry Zbysko at Shea Stadium and drawing. How many people did they draw? And this is, like, 17 years after he won the title. And yep. So, like, going back to the earlier point, I think the guy could have went at least 20 years. And it would have only been when he was good and, you know, ready to go home, that he would have gave up the belt if he was that kind of person. But, if you know, of course, he loved his family and he got, you know, he had the injuries and everything. But, and, you know, going back to Gino Hernandez, I heard that Gino had to wrestle Johnny Rods at the Garden. And I think I heard Johnny taught him a little bit of a lesson in wrestling.
Yeah, well, Johnny lit him up is what happened.
Good.
A lot of people might not have seen it because they didn't know what was going on. Johnny, first of all, I'm one of the people that sent a card to White Plains Hospital, okay, as a fan for Arnold Skolin. So our fan history is pretty close to...
But didn't you believe that? Like, I thought, like, oh, my God, this poor guy's in the hospital.
I was in tears.
Yeah.
I was in tears. Oh, yeah, did I believe it? Oh, my God. Unbelievable. Yes. So, but Gino, you know... Johnny Rods is the consummate professional. I mean, he did it all in this business. He didn't travel around a lot. He just didn't want to go on the road too much. You know, he did the thing out in California as Jabba Rook.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. And he could have drawn money all over the country. All over the country. He just didn't want to do it. But for whatever reason, Johnny said to Vince Sr., when Gino came in here, Vince, I never refuse anything. Not this time. Not this time. We're not doing this. So there was a little discussion, and they straightened things out. But Johnny made him realize that championship belt you're walking around with from Detroit, you could have hung that on anybody. You know, no big deal. Keep in mind, brother, it's a work. It's a work. Mm-hmm. You're not the champion because you're a tough guy. There's not a lot of those guys around. Okay?
Johnny Rod said an early Iron Sheik and made him humble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was unreal. Was unreal. And you know, things like that happened all the time. Things like that happened all the time. I had an incident with Vince Sr. in the Garden with somebody that was coming in for one shot, you know, and we worked it out. But guys that were making a living in the business, and I'll only attribute this lesson for me because I learned it from the best. I learned it from guys like Bruno and Dominic and Mike and, you know, like the old timers, Johnny, P. Sanchez, Manny Soto. You know, these were the guys that I was surrounded by in the business. And if there was something that didn't make any sense, something that may have made a joke or exposed us, it didn't happen. We just didn't let that happen. Okay, that's why Johnny wasn't going to let something happen with Hernandez. That, you know, the guy I had the problem, I didn't have a problem with him, we took care of it, was David Von Erich. Now, David Von Erich was the best worker in the family. He was the best in that family. But I just didn't think it was good business. You know, and I talked to Bruno after, and Bruno said, well, you could have handled it a little differently. You know, he said you didn't have to do that Irish temper guy thing, you know, but you know, that's another thing. Bruno brought such respect to the business that it rubbed off on people. And part of the respect was protecting the business. Part of the respect was protecting the business. And Bruno did that too.
You know, you guys mentioned time and time again the crowds, and I believe you said earlier the money doesn't lie. It's funny to think you have to put just crowd and power in perspective. Before the pandemic hit last year in January at Madison Square Garden, Billy Joel did his 72nd consecutive show there. He's been a resident for 6 years now. And they made a big deal. It was 72 consecutive sellouts. It's funny to think the record with everything kind of slowly getting back to normal, Billy Joel would have to do a show once a month at the Garden until he is 90 in order to break
Bruno's
record.
Not even halfway there.
So, I mean, it's this close. You know, the fact that you're talking about in an era when tickets are easier to get, shows are easier to go to, easier to advertise. Everything is national now. You're still short significantly of 187 consecutive sellouts.
Yeah.
I think it's funny, and you have to think about it. Benny told the story, and you guys talked about being fans. You're talking. This isn't where, you know, I traveled as a kid and growing up in Maryland. Some of the local shows in like Baltimore. I mean, 1500 people was a big crowd. This is Madison Square Garden. This is thousands of people for 187 consecutive shows. And
yeah,
like you mentioned, I think what really impresses me studying the history of everything is in the territory days, you could live 100 miles from a territory and have no idea what's happening. You didn't see the TV. There was really no big national broadcasts. And
exactly.
Magazines,
yeah, exactly.
And ESPN came in later. But you had fans out in California, fans out in Texas, as far away from the New York wrestling scene as you can get, that knew what was happening in New York because it was so big.
Yep.
And I just think it's impressive. And I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts on how you had a star that literally transcended popularity. That wasn't just wrestling fans, sports fans. There in the papers, Benny, you mentioned it on the last time we did a Bruno tribute show last year. In the sports pages, next to the scores for the Mets, the Yankees, was an article about, hey, Bruno said this or this happened.
Oh yeah,
I mean, it was a popularity level that you just don't see anymore.
Oh yeah, and that's why so many promoters all over, not just the country but the world, were in touch with Vince Sr. saying, "Can you spare him? Can you spare him for a shot?" St. Louis, Indianapolis, L.A., wherever. I mean, that was unheard of for other guys to do that. You know, the NWA champs were really busy champions, and they'd be all over the place. But many, many times, St. Louis was a great NWA town. Great NWA town. I worked there. I worked Kansas City territory. But you know who drew really big in the St. Louis Kiel Auditorium? Bruno. 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 Bruno sold the place out. There were other guys on a card, yeah. But the attraction was Bruno. How many times he was back and forth across the country just because of who he was. People loved him. People loved him. And as far as business went, you know, we used to get our bookings usually at TV. We did TV in the New York territory on a Tuesday or Wednesday every 3 weeks, and started out in Philadelphia, then Allentown and Hamburg, Pennsylvania. And you'd look at the book, you'd bring your book over, and you'd write down 4 or 5 weeks of your schedule. I know what guys did. They'd take a look, and you'd look at the card because it was in the book. You'd see who was in the town with you. And first thing you'd look at is who was on top. Oh, great. Okay, Bruno's on top. You know, we're going to Providence, Rhode Island. Bruno's on top. Okay, that'll be a good night. All right, next night, Boston Garden. Bruno's there. Oh, that's going to be a great night. That's going to be a great night. You know, where are we going after this? You know, and so he, his popularity for the people getting into the seats, but his popularity was with us too, because we knew when he was there, we were making some money. It was great.
I, you know, I have another question along those lines. After Sagos.
Go ahead.
Let me just jump in here real quick. When guys came into New York to the Garden, let's say, whatever, most of that was done as favors to other promoters or talent. Like, you know, quite honestly, you know, Ricky Steamboat and I have had a very long relationship. And you know, he requested that Jim Crockett get him and Jay Youngblood to come to the Garden. So these kind of things were done. But if you look at it, all of these people that came in from out of town, they weren't opening matches. When Bruno went to other territories, he was in the main event.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's a huge difference there in how this all actually works from that perspective. They weren't sending him places to open up the card. They were sending him places to draw money. And,
exactly.
And obviously it was that's what was happening. The biggest story, of course, would be the Jim Barnett story because, you know, Barnett, quite honestly, is one of the guys that helped start Bruno out when he was blackballed. So when he wanted him in Australia, you know, he really didn't want to go. But he said, if I've got to go, this is what it's going to cost. If he doesn't want me, it's okay, too. But, of course, he paid it. And he sat down there and he told Bruno, he said, my boy, it was very expensive to get you here, but it was worth it. We sold out every night.
Yep. Yep, he did. Hey, listen, like you said, he was when he went somewhere, he was going on top. David Von Erich, rest his soul, nice kid, guy. He was getting ready to get the NWA strap hung on him.
Yes, sir.
It was all set to go. So he came to the Garden, the mecca of professional wrestling. Well, who did he work with? Well, he worked with some jabroni named Davey O'Hannon. Bruno went to St. Louis. He was on top. So exactly what Sal said. These guys would come in. I mean, Flair came in for his first Garden appearance. I think he worked with Pete Sanchez.
Pete Sanchez, I saw that on HBO. And, yes, sir.
And listen, that's not a knock on Pete. Pete is was a fantastic worker.
Pete always gave a great match.
And Pete had a mind for the business that was fantastic. Pete was the youngest person to ever hold an NWA title belt. He and Mario Milano had a tag belt. I don't know. I think they were Cleveland or wherever they were. Pete was a real good hand in the ring. You know, the only problem with Pete, we used to call him Sybil because we just never knew what personality was going to show up. You know, so, but, you know, these guys came in. Flair came in. David Von Erich came in. You know, whoever came in to work the Garden. Listen, J.J. Dillon had a real solid history in this business. You know, we all know what he did wrestling. And then with the Four Horsemen, man, nobody was more over than those guys. Nobody was more. J.J. didn't work the Garden until the very end of his career. Till the very end of his career. Eddie Graham set it up for him. Eddie Graham called Vince Sr. and said, hey, listen, I want to send Dillon up there for you. Sure, set him up. And JJ, who I'm very close with, told me, he said, that was a dream come true. Because all the stuff I got to do in the business, at that point, I had never worked in the Madison Square Garden. That was really something. That was really something. But, you know, back to, this is about Bruno, and it should be always about Bruno. Bruno went somewhere on top. That's how it was. And it wasn't because he said, I'm not going to do anything else. He wasn't that kind of personality. But the promoters knew good business, and they knew who would draw for them. And that's how that worked.
I have a question for both Davey and Sal. So, Davey, one of the in your chapter of Sal's book, or the book, you told Bruno, you said, you're the face of wrestling. And then Bruno's comment was, well, couldn't you find a prettier face?
That's what he said,
and
yeah.
I remember that when I had the pleasure of meeting Bruno, I actually had dinner at Rico's with Bruno and Dominic DiNucci. It was on December 17th, 2017, a few months before he passed away. And, you know, I read a tribute to Bruno out loud in front of everybody. I became 13 years old again. And,
uh-huh.
And one of the things I said at the very end was, I said, Bruno, please, you know, whatever I'm saying here, multiply it by 2 or 3 million.
Yep.
And that's what you mean to this world. And you could tell that he was legitimately touched by what I said. And I'm a nobody, but I guess my question is to both of you. I don't really think Bruno even realized how, like, what he meant to everybody, because he was just that humble. Am I mistaken there?
Oh, you're not mistaken at all. If I could answer first here. First time I noticed that, I was working in the Westchester County Center up in White Plains, and Bruno was on the card. You know, we were sitting in the dressing room. I don't know, toward the end of the night, I was all done, and he was all done. We're getting dressed. And he says to me, Davey, he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going home. I lived in New Jersey. And he said, oh, geez. I said, what's the matter? He said, I got to get back to the city. I didn't have a... He said, would you mind dropping me off? I said, would Davey O'Hanlon mind driving Bruno to New York City? I said to him, listen carefully. You're Bruno. You get it? I don't have to say anything else. You're Bruno. Of course I'll take you to New York City. Of course. And that goes right in, you know, years and years later, when I said to him, you don't get it, man. You're the face of this business. And that's when he said to me, well, couldn't we find a prettier face? I think I said, no, probably not. But, you know, you're so right about that. You're so right about that. It's unreal. He was humble. He was humble.
Yeah, you know, he would say to me many times, Sal, what is it with you people? What is it that I don't get? you know, because sometimes he would mention how nice a guy was, and I would say, Bruno, this guy's been really that well. He was like this with me, but you're Bruno. They're not going to show who they really are to you. To the rest of us, it doesn't matter. Now, the difference is, a guy like Bruno, like Benny, you said you're a nobody. I can assure you this. One, Bruno would have never accepted that you're a nobody. Two, there's a whole lot of nobodies out there that fed his family for years and years because they filled up arenas, and he appreciated that. But the truth is, Bruno treated everybody the same. I mean, he honestly, truthfully did. You would have had to do something to give a reason for him not to treat you the same. It's really amazing to watch him with people and watch people around him, the impact that he had. I mean, I listened to you describe your situation, but I saw that so many times. I mean, you know, one time Bruno said to me, Sal, the guy was crying. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say to him. Well, look, what can you say? You know, what can you say? You spent time with him. You spoke with him. You signed his sign. I mean, that's all you can do. You know, but he didn't understand having that kind of impact on people.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was and he was so good with people. That when I grew up in Colonia, New Jersey, you know, the little town, and there was an Italian shoemaker in my town that made my first pair of wrestling shoes for me. And his name was Rocco. And I'm in there one day, and he used to say to me, oh, you know Bruno Sammartino. And then, he really, really mostly spoke Italian. You know, I used to hear that from my great-grandmother or my grandfather. But, you know, I didn't know how to speak Italian. And then one day his son was there. I said, hey, do you think your father would like to say hello to Bruno? He said, would he like to say hello to Bruno? He said, well, you better call the first aid squad first. He said, in case he has a heart attack. So I went home. I wasn't carrying Bruno. Well, we didn't have cell phones or anything. I got his number. I came back. I said, Rocco, let me use your phone for a minute. And I called him up. I said, hey, Bruno. I said, would you do me a favor? He said, what? I said, I'm here at the shoemaker that does my wrestling stuff. His name is Rocco. Would you say hello? He said, well, of course I'd say hello. I put him on the phone, and 45 minutes later, I had to say, I'm going. I'll see you. I'm leaving. His son came to me later and said, I'm going to tell you something. I have never seen my father so happy. He said he hung up the phone and he was in tears. That's what he said. He said he hung up the phone and he was in tears. That's how Bruno was. Bruno was such a good heart. It was just, it's just so hard to describe. You know, it's just so hard to describe. I mean, I'm so fortunate that I was able to call him friend. You know, I always hoped that he felt the same way. You know, I think he did. But he was so sincere and such a good person, unreal.
It wasn't just the you touched on it earlier, his national, it was a global appeal. When I got into writing about professional wrestling, one of the first matches that I delved into as the historian side of things was a match that took place March 7th, 1967, and it was Bruno Sammartino against Giant Baba in what was back then called Japan Pro Wrestling Alliance.
Oh, wow.
And it's oddly enough, I didn't realize it at the time, but it's one of the oldest surviving full start to finish Bruno matches. But you hear the crowd. Now, this was in an era, and what made it so fascinating, the 1960s, Japan, the Japanese audience wasn't a big fan of the American wrestling style.
No,
or
they weren't.
Really, Americans in general. And Bruno got a hero's welcome in Japan. He obviously not compared to the way the crowd reacted to Baba, but I mean, you have a guy who's, he was at this point well into his title reign. You've got the Foreigner, the who knows what we're going to do with him, and you put him in a match against your biggest star overseas in an era when the crowd could probably not, I don't want to say care less, but they weren't really into seeing the American wrestlers, and Bruno still delivered and still got the crowd. And there's a great picture. We saw it on it came up when we did the anniversary show last year of Bruno and Dominic DiNucci outside of a temple in Japan. It's, you know, really, this is a funny shot, but it's impressive the global scale. Like, you know, you talk about in an era when there was really outside of the Beatles, the idea of being a global superstar for anything other than music and Hollywood was unheard of. And here was Bruno being a global star.
Global, one of the most recognized people in the world.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny that you mentioned Baba. I mean, it sure sounds like that our early history, our fan history, has some parallels, because I remember as a kid watching Ray Morgan interview Bruno, and Baba came on the interview and kind of stepped behind Bruno as he was talking and put the Japanese, the feared, dreaded Japanese sleeper on Bruno. This is when they were getting ready to do their program. He put the sleeper on Bruno, and I'll never forget Bruno kind of collapsing down and all the hubbub that went with it. And he said, speak of Pearl Harbor. Speak of Pearl Harbor. This was the angle and the promo they shot to get Baba over here in the country.
Wow.
Is that... And I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm curious. I remember watching a lot of the tapes when I was a kid, and especially like a Gorilla Monsoon or somebody like that. In the 70s, the 60s and 70s, it was common to describe getting attacked from behind as Pearl Harboring somebody. Is that where that came from?
Well, I was a kid. I was a fan watching this, and I'm saying to myself, oh boy, I really hope this isn't the one that's going to take Bruno's title away. Look at the size of this guy. You know, and I think was Red Berry his manager? I just don't recall who the manager was, but he's standing there, and I'm saying, "Oh boy!" And I just like it happened yesterday. It was Bruno going down, starting to succumb to the sleeper, and saying, speak of Pearl Harbor. Well, you know, there's a parallel right there. Baba is a Japanese guy, you know. So you didn't have to imagine much. He just put that thought into people's heads. But there it was. I mean, they were really, really close friends. They were really good friends. And another dream come true for me is, you know, my first Japan trip. I went over and worked for Baba. Oh, what do you know? Who sent me there? Bruno. You know, Bruno sent me there. But you saw him with Baba, and like Sal said, it wasn't the same thing week in and week out, month in and month out. It was always something different. And his appeal, whether it was in Japan or Australia or wherever, and it wasn't just as a wrestler. As a wrestler, you know what a stir he caused at the World's Fair in New York? I think it was 1964. I'm not sure when it was. I think it was 64. He was at the World's 64. Fair. Everything came to a stop. Everything came to a stop. Here was Bruno Sammartino. Unbelievable.
And he also had an audience with the Pope, which was unheard of.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is before all the social media and how easy it was to advertise things, how easy it is now. None of that stuff happened. None of that stuff happened. You depended on a TV promo or a newspaper article. That was it. You know, maybe radio.
You guys had to be salesmen. You had to sell tickets.
Oh, yeah. Sure you did. But he sold tickets.
Hey, Davey. Tell that story about the dumbbells with Gino and you.
Oh, you know what? And like I said to you before, you know, here's a guy that had the title. If he wanted to keep it, if he wanted to be a real hard ass, he could have said, oh, yeah, you want to switch the title? Well, why don't you get somebody to take it away from me? I was getting ready for a road trip, and you know, I was really close friends with Monsoon. We were very, very close. And I guess I was down south. I lived in central New Jersey. He lived down in Willingboro, New Jersey, which is in South Jersey. Anyway, he said to me, he said, you know, you got to go out there. He said, you going to pick me up? I said, yeah, I'll pick you up. You know, I'm coming up from Baltimore, Delaware, wherever the hell I was. I don't know. So I just bought a new 76 Coupe de Ville. So I pull up to Gino's house, and I get in the driveway, and he says I got to drop something off at the Nose's house, not in front of him, but they used to call Bruno Pinocchio sometimes because his nose was so messed up. You know, we could kid with him about it, but anyway, he says I got to drop something off at the Nose. I said, well, what do you got? He says, well, come with me. So I walk into his backyard with him, and he's got two 140-pound dumbbells on the back porch. They're holding down a picnic table and an umbrella. I said, what do we got to bring to Bruno? He says, these dumbbells. I said, you're kidding. I said, what are you doing with these dumbbells? He says, they're holding down my picnic table is what they're doing. I said, all right. He says, well, come on, we got to put them in the trunk of the car. Okay. So here's Gino and I. You know, we were still in pretty good shape, and Monsoon was a great athlete.
Yes.
You know, keep that in mind. He was a big, strong guy. You know, he could do cartwheels and all kinds of stuff. He says, okay, let's get these. So here's Gino and I each grab an end of these 140-pound one of them, and we shuffle our way to the front of the house and put it in the trunk of the car. We go back and get the other one, you know, put it in the trunk. I looked at him, and I said, Jesus Christ. Who the hell's going to lift these things up? Eh, he says, nah, he wants them. I said, okay. So we get on the road, and, you know, eventually we get to Pittsburgh. And I back into Bruno's driveway, and he must have seen us coming, or he was outside or something. So I popped the trunk, and, how you doing? Geez, haven't seen you in a few weeks. Everything okay? Yeah, how's your kids? How's that? Fine. All right. He says to Gino, did you bring those things for me? Yeah, they're right here. So we walked to the trunk with Bruno. He looked inside, kind of shrugged his shoulders, reached in with two hands, picked up both 140-pound dumbbells. Yeah. said, I got to put them downstairs. What? Wait a minute. I looked at Gino. Gino used to kind of slide his glasses down his nose because his eyesight was so bad that he couldn't even see through his glasses. And he looked at me and he went, I don't know, what the hell? Yeah, Bruno just grabbed these two things and walked like they were foam dumbbells. It was unbelievable. I mean, he was like scary strong.
Yes.
He was scary strong. I was in one battle royal with him, which was very rare because he wasn't in a lot of them. But wherever we were, he was in the, or he ran and he did something. And I gave him a shot on the chest, like an uppercut. I bent him over and I uppercutted him on the chest. And I looked at him and I went, well, thanks very much. I just hurt my wrist. He just shook his head and walked and was dealing with somebody else. I said to him later, he says, were you serious? I said, yeah, I was serious. I said, I punched you on the chest. I hurt my wrist. I said, Jesus Christ, Bruno. Come on.
It was unreal. Cement.
Oh, Jesus. He was unreal. Listen, there weren't a lot of guys in the business that were better conditioned than Bugsy McGraw. Bugsy could go for hours. He was really, he didn't look like it, but if you look at an early picture of Bugsy when he was working as the Brute, I mean, he was a sight to behold. And he told me, now Bugsy and I are close, we still talk, and he says to me, oh man, he said, well, I was going to work with him that night. I said to myself, I'm going to blow him up. I said, no, you're not. I said, that's not going to happen. He said, I slammed him. Now, if you're not prepared for a body slam, you know, it kind of knocks a little bit of the wind out of you. Bugsy slammed Bruno three or four consecutive times. Boom, boom, boom. Really tough. And did something. Bugsy said, I looked up, and he was running in place in the corner, ready for me again. I said, yeah. So, you know, I mean, Bruno was the total package. But, and I keep repeating, and I'm sorry if I am repeating, not only the total package as a wrestler, he was the total package as a wonderful, fantastic human being. He was unbelievable.
Go ahead.
Those who had the chance to get close to him, I mean, I'm asked all the time, why you? And I don't really have much of any kind of an idea why me. But we all very much appreciated it. And, you know, the time he gave us, the attention he gave us, what he was willing to do. And, you know, like he made appearances for me in the winter. Well, he wouldn't travel anywhere when, you know, bookings would come in. He said, Sal, don't take anything until after April 1st. I'm not going anywhere outside. I'm not flying. But he came down to Tampa for Wrestle Reunion. Yep. Which he would not have done. He flew to California for me, which he didn't want to fly to California for anything anymore. But he was happy, too, to go down there and see people like Bugsy. He hadn't seen Bugsy in years. And yeah. It was tough tracking Bugsy down. I had to call the hospital where he was working. It was not easy. And quite honestly, Tully Blanchard had called me because, we booked him to wrestle Jeff Jarrett for the NWA title. And he called and asked, would I book his father on the show? And I said, sure, Tully, if, you know, that's what you want, sure. So I told Bruno about it, and he said, Sal, Joe Blanchard is dead. He's passed on. And I said, well, Bruno, Tully called me and asked, could I book his father? He said, are you sure it's not some guy that worked as his father? I said, look, I said, I don't know what to tell you. So I called Tully. I said, Tully, this is your real father? He said, well, yeah. And then Bruno called Dominic DiNucci, and Dominic told him that Joe Blanchard had died. But I still remember when Tully came across the room with his father and found Bruno. Bruno jumped out of the chair and he was just looking at him amazed because in his mind, this man wasn't alive at the time.
Wow.
So, you know, Bruno did appreciate the chance to come down and get to see several of the guys. But, you know, I don't know about Davey, but I don't know why me. I just hope that I lived up to it. I hope the book tells the right story. People do seem to like it. People that understand wrestling and people that don't. I've had several people in Hollywood read it and that know nothing about wrestling. And it really is a story. You know, it's a wrestler and his life more than it is a wrestling book.
Yeah.
And that was certainly the goal. And I'm glad that he finally gave me the okay to start rewriting the book. And that really came about very simply because I said, Bruno, I heard you do an interview. You were speaking quite openly. And look, I'm just going to say flat out what he told me. He said, Sal, look, I can't go around looking like a jerk. Everybody else is on all these programs saying everything. I said, well, okay, if that's the way you feel, then maybe it's time to rewrite the book. He said, if that's what you want to do, let's do it. And that was how the rewrite of the book came along. And, of course, bringing it forward 20 years as well. But that was it. It was basically a two-minute conversation.
Yeah, it was... He was very, very sensitive to his image also, and that was important to him. It was listen, if we were in a restaurant and somebody, the guys that I hung with, I mean, we all drank, we had some beers or wine or whatever. Some guys did it to excess. I just, I wasn't with that group of guys too often. Sometimes I did, but if Bruno was in a restaurant and he had a glass of wine in front of him, and there were kids in the restaurant, he had to take it off the table. That's how sensitive he was to how the people perceived him and how he was respectful of them. He didn't want somebody saying, well, I saw Bruno Sammartino drinking. Yeah, I mean, it's reasonable to have a glass of wine, I guess, with your dinner. Nope, he didn't do it. He didn't do it. He was such an honest guy. He really would not tolerate dishonesty. He just, he was a tough guy when it came to if you're his friend or you wanted to be, if you weren't upfront and honest about things. Dominic and I used to joke all the time. Yep, he scratched another one out of the book. He says, that address is gone. He said, that's all done. That's all done. It was the whole package with him. It really was.
I have a question for Sal. Actually, it's a two-part question. I always do these two-part questions. So, Sal, writing the book... And I think it was 567 pages, I believe. Close.
It was 568, but...
Okay, I was close. That's in the plus or minus 1%. But, and you have so many great tributes. You got Davey, you got Stan Hansen, Larry Zbysko, Dominic, Apa, Jimmy Hart, my friend Mike Miggott. Just my opinion... And this is the first part of the question, is that it could have been a 2,000-page book. And, the other part of the question is that it had to be very difficult writing the book, after Bruno was gone, finishing the book. So comments on both of those.
Well, let me say this. The book was complete before Bruno was gone.
Okay.
What was not complete was the editing and that stuff. That was not complete. And then, of course, because it was becoming clear to me that we were running into a problem, I did not continue. And I was struggling to find the right editor. I talked to some pretty good writers and stuff. And ultimately, in the long run, Colin Bowman, who used to WCW Magazine and is a brilliant mind himself. If I ever do events again, I don't do anything without Colin. And this is a person Jimmy Hart introduced me to. And I said, hey, Jimmy, I finally found the right editor for the book. He said, oh, yeah, who's that? I said, Jimmy, you don't know? He said, oh, Colin. And I said, yeah, right. He did all of it after Bruno passed. But the book was written. Now, one of the last things we added was the tribute from Mike Miggott. And, then I started looking at other things, and Colin said, Sal, look. He said, it's time to stop now. He said, this book could easily be over 1,000 pages. He said, we've got enough. But, if we just keep going, it's going to be over 1,000 pages, and it's going to be ridiculous. So, first of all, I give tremendous credit to Colin Bowman. His efforts were unbelievable in putting his book together. And it eventually, and Colin had met Bruno a few times. over the years. The last time was when we did their 605 reunion. I had Bruno come down to Orlando. That was Bruno's first appearance ever in Orlando, by the way. When he came to Florida, it was, I think, Tampa, Miami, St. Petersburg. He had never been in Orlando. But the book eventually became a passion for Colin. Before it was a job for a friend, it eventually became a passion for him. So yeah, the book could have been, it could have really, really went on and on. But yes, so Bruno, it was all written. Matter of fact, the last time I talked to him, it was the last phone conversation we had. I asked him some questions about his mother, and that was pretty much the end, right there. So it was really just a matter of editing and putting it together to get it out. But the things like additional contributions from other people like Mike Miggett, you know, he obviously didn't know about that. But those are things that, you know, either I or Colin discovered and decided we wanted to put in. But anything that had to do directly with him, that was all done.
Gotcha.
An incredible book, an incredible story. Benny mentioned it at the beginning of the show. The book can be found on Amazon. Benny, you mind holding that up one more time just to...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
wait, I'm going to hold up where Sal autographed my version of it while he's eating
fancy.
Paper hot dog there. Yeah.
I'll have to find
a way.
The
one thing I want to say about the book is we did two versions. We did a black and white version and a color version. Quite honestly, color printing is very expensive, and the color book is not cheap. But the true, real Bruno fans that have bought the color book, and there have been several, you know, I think they really appreciate that. But I do want to mention, if anybody looks at the price, the way the printing works is if you have one color page, and that's why we put 250 color pictures in, because we were originally going to do a very small color version to try to make it cost effective. But Amazon said, no, when you have one color page, you have 568 color pages. So that's why we threw so many color pictures in the book. But it is pretty amazing to see those pictures. But black and white version, color version. You know, read the story about the man. The way Davey put it is best. This was a guy who's so much more than a wrestler, and I think that's really truthfully what you get out of the book.
Yep. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I've read it, I don't know how many times I've read it, and not just parts of it, not because I was so fortunate to even be mentioned in there or had a picture. It's because I love Bruno. You know, he was... my idol, and then he was my friend, and he was a friend to my family. My kids grew up knowing who he was and how important he was to us. It's just unbelievable, just unbelievable. Somebody said to me once, "Wow, you know, your kids must have had some childhood. The people they were around." Yeah, they did, and. One of the most important was Bruno.
Absolutely. And I cannot, and I know Benny stressed it too, I cannot recommend this book enough to not just Bruno fans, but wrestling historians, wrestling fans, and just anybody who appreciates really sports in general, because it paints such a picture of how... an athlete, you told the story about, but the wine glass, an athlete can change people's lives. And it's incredible. Like you said, it can be found on Amazon, Autobiography of Wrestling's Living Legend, Bruno Sammartino. It's funny. We say this every time, Benny, don't we? Every time we do interviews like this, we could talk for another couple of hours and not scratch the surface many stories we have. Gentlemen, I mean, I cannot thank you enough for being on the show. We'll definitely have to have you back. Sal, Davey, you guys have been great. I thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate you sharing stories of your friend, and this means a lot to us.
Well, thank you so much. I'm honestly flattered that you would consider having me on here. It's a big deal for me. It's a big deal to talk about Bruno, and you know, us old timers appreciate very much that you remember us, and thank you again for giving us this forum to talk about our friend and the business that we loved.
So yeah, thank you again so much. You know, I'll end on a note, a personal story. One of my first, I guess maybe the centerpiece of my autograph wall is a picture Bruno signed for me at a convention. This was years ago. It was of all the pairings, it was actually Bruno and Ivan Koloff were the two wrestling guests, and both of them just truly appreciative of fans, especially some of the younger ones. Like these were, you know, it was really humbling. And I've worked, I know I've told the stories on the show before. I've worked as a liaison with various celebrities and athletes through the years in the convention scene. And really, I mean, you guys know, you've seen it in the locker rooms. You can have some really kind of rough around the edges people that don't quite appreciate what they have. And Bruno was start to finish just genuinely, he knew. I mean, Benny told the story, you know, from eating dandelions, hiding from the Germans. You had to literally a line wrapped around the building to meet him.
Yep.
25 years after he had stopped wrestling, still biggest draw of the night, biggest draw of the show. I mean, you put his name anywhere and you would sell tickets, and it was just, yep, he greatly appreciated it. And you guys have really put a human spin on a larger than life icon. And again, I appreciate it. You guys have done great for us. We'll definitely have to have you back. So for Sal Corrente, for Davey O'Hannon and Benny Scala, I'm Dan Sebastiano. Y'all have a great night. And as always, everyone, happy wrestling.
Take care. Thank you.
Good night. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.